From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, reaction in Europe to the Bush administration, its planned invasion of Iraq, and its position on the Middle East. We talk with Steve Erlanger, Berlin bureau chief for the New York Times, and he'll tell us how the European Union and the euro are changing the lives of Europeans. Also, comparing the messages that religions and astronomers have perceived in the skies, we talk with astronomer and physicist Marcelo Gleiser, author of The Prophet and the Astronomer. And Phil Donahue has returned to TV with a new show on MSNBC. David Bianculli has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The man accused of conspiring in the September 11th attack says he wants to plead guilty. A judge refused to accept the plea from Zacharias Moussaoui today, giving him a week to think it over. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
Moussaoui was appearing in a Virginia federal court for a new indictment when he announced to the judge he wanted to plead guilty. Judge Leonie Brinkema has struggled for weeks with Moussaoui since he decided he wants to be his own attorney. This time she warned him that if he pleads guilty, he would have to accept the entire government indictment. And since prosecutors want the death penalty, that could lead to his execution. She indicated he should consider first working out a plea agreement with prosecutors, but said she could not be part of that discussion. Moussaoui insisted he wanted to plead guilty to some of the charges and then said he thought this would save him from the death penalty. He told the judge he was a member of Al-Qaeda and said he'd sworn allegiance to Osama bin Laden. The judge adjourned the court and told Moussaoui to reappear next week. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
Former Secret Service Chief John McGaugh has stepped down as head of the agency formed to protect the nation's transportation system from terrorist attacks. McGaugh will be replaced as head of the Transportation Security Administration by former Coast Guard Commandant James Loy. McGaugh's resignation letter cited poor health as his reason for leaving. The secretary has come under criticism from members of Congress and airport officials for the speed and cost of his proposed airport security measures. McGaugh was also accused of spending too much on his office and the administrators hired to run the new agency. Army Secretary Thomas White defended his record as an executive at Enron today. White, who left Enron in May of last year, was testifying for the first time before the Senate Energy and Commerce Committee. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
Army Secretary White told the panel he had acted in what he called an entirely ethical manner during his 11 years at Enron, but several senators pointed to accusations from former employees that White had misled investors about the money-losing unit he headed at Enron. Chairman Byron Dorgan, a North Dakota Democrat, asked White about the $12 million he made last year selling off Enron stock.
Have you given any thought to returning some of those gains that you received during this period?
No, I have not.
And why not?
Because I don't consider the gains for running the business in a responsible way to be ill-gotten.
Dorgan and others on the committee called on the Securities and Exchange Commission to investigate White. David Wellner, NPR News, The Capitol.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 133 points, or 1.5%, to close at 8,409 in very heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost 40 points, or 2.9%. It closed at 1356. This is NPR News. President Bush said today that this week's attacks on Israeli civilians will not deter the United States from seeking peace in the Middle East. The president spoke to reporters shortly before a meeting with foreign ministers from Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. Part of the meeting focused on U.S. demands that the Palestinian Authority reform its institutions in exchange for U.S. help in establishing a Palestinian state. Boston's Cardinal Bernard Law has completed another day of questioning. The cardinal's being deposed in connection with the church's withdrawal from a multi-million-dollar settlement with alleged victims of priest abuse. Monica Brady Meyerhoff reports from member station WBUR.
In a March press release, Cardinal Law said the settlement reached with 86 alleged victims of priest abuse was, quote, an important step in reaching closure for these victims. But during questioning under oath today, Cardinal Law reportedly said there was no final agreement. Alleged victim Mark Keene sat in on the deposition.
Today he concentrated on trying to convince everybody that there was never a settlement, that it was a proposed settlement. In the press releases, we should have written proposed settlement. I think that would have been better for everybody if we had said proposed settlement.
A hearing will be held at the end of the month for a judge to determine whether or not the archdiocese will be forced to adhere to the settlement. For NPR News, I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov in Boston.
The House Ethics Committee says it will announce tomorrow whether Representative James Traficant should be expelled from Congress. Earlier today, the committee found the Ohio Democrat guilty of 9 ethics violations, including bribery, conspiracy, and racketeering. Traficant is appealing his convictions on corruption charges. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Subaru, maker of a full line of all-wheel drive vehicles like the Outback, Forester, and WRX. Subaru, the beauty of all-wheel drive.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ever since September 11th, we've really needed the help and cooperation of our European allies. But what do Europe's current leaders think of the Bush administration's plans to invade Iraq? My guest, Steve Erlanger, is the Berlin bureau chief for The New York Times. We invited him to talk with us about this and to discuss how life is changing abroad in the new era of the European Union and the euro. Erlanger has held many positions at the Times, including bureau chief for Central Europe and the Balkans, Moscow bureau chief, and chief diplomatic correspondent in Washington. As the European Union is getting stronger, the United States still remains the only superpower. Let's talk about how the United States is looking right now in Europe, more specifically how President Bush is looking right now in Europe. And let's begin with the United States' plan to invade Iraq. How much support does that have among European leaders?
Well, among Europeans as a population, it probably has little to no support, but no one's really going to ask them. Among European leaders, there's a kind of shrugging, almost a feeling that, you know, if this is something the United States desperately wants to do, the Europeans will have to find some way of going along with it. But they have problems with it, they have problems with the timing, they have serious questions about how it would work. They're worried about destabilization of the Middle East, and in large part, they think the central problem of the Middle East is the Israeli-Palestinian problem and the deterioration in relations there. They do not see Saddam Hussein as a backer of al-Qaeda, or even as a major supporter of international terrorism. And they think the obsession with Iraq on the part of the Bush administration is probably a little theological, a little puzzling, a little troubling, but very difficult to stop.
Now, the Bush administration seems convinced that Iraq has a supply of biological weapons, chemical weapons, and that they're in the process of making nuclear weapons. What's your understanding of why the United States is so confident of this and that yet the European leaders seem unconcerned?
Well, I don't think the European leaders disagree with that intelligence assessment. I mean, the intelligence is kind of widely shared. Europeans, and I've talked to some of the intelligence people about this here, they do not believe Saddam Hussein is close to getting nuclear weapons, though he's been trying to make them, as we know, for quite a long time. They do believe he has some stocks of biological and chemical weapons, which, you know, bother everyone a great deal. The question becomes one of threat. As a Frenchman put to me, a French diplomat, you know, you Americans think it's safer to kill the crocodile. We tend to think it's better to drain the swamp. In other words, people are worried that an effort to overthrow Saddam by force could have lots of unintended consequences and involve the use of those very weapons on American and allied soldiers in the field. let alone against Israel. And they fear that it will lead to new attacks on allied troops by al-Qaeda and other angry Arab forces, and that it will do little to stabilize the state of Israel or help along the problems with turning the idea of a democratic and nonviolent Palestinian state into reality.
If the United States does, in fact, proceed with the plan to invade Iraq and try to overthrow Saddam Hussein, can the Bush administration expect to get any support from Europe, particularly troop support?
I think it can, yes. And the reason is, as we all remember, the unfinished business of the Iraq War. And by that, I don't really mean the existence of Saddam Hussein. I mean the fact that, you know, the UN resolutions that govern the end of that war are still valid, and Iraq is out of compliance with them. Iraq has not, for a very long time now, allowed UN inspectors into Iraq to search out and destroy these efforts at producing weapons of mass destruction. So that legally, Iraq is in defiance of UN Security Council resolution. And many international lawyers would argue, not just in America, that, you know, the ceasefire resolution that ended that war has been breached, and hence the state of war continues. So the allies, you know, who are with the United States during the Gulf War, I think will, if the evidence is clear and if Saddam Hussein continues to reject sincere efforts to let inspectors go through his country and declare it free of weapons of mass destruction, the Europeans will have no choice but to go along, I think, with the United States. Certainly not without having long discussions with Washington, which are already going on, about what kind of campaign, how long it would last, what, and most important, you know, what happens in Iraq afterwards.
Steve Erlanger is my guest. He's the Berlin bureau chief for the New York Times. Let's look at the Middle East and how Europe and the Bush administration stand there. President Bush has basically said he doesn't think Arafat is a viable peace partner. What about the European leaders? How are they reacting to President Bush's position?
Once again, they're reacting with a large degree of understanding. I mean, in the sense that, you know, Yasser Arafat has annoyed a lot of people and a lot of, you know, Western leaders for a long time. And no one's had any real illusions, you know, that he's a Democrat fully in charge of all Palestinians. However, the Europeans more than the Americans seem to feel that he is the at least mostly elected representative of the Palestinian people, and he can't simply be discarded. The German foreign minister, Joschka Fischer, has produced a paper to allies, which is being looked at and worked on, which suggests an immediate naming of a prime minister for the Palestinian territories, basically pushing Yasser Arafat upstairs to a kind of ceremonial presidential post, but putting day-to-day control of Palestinian life in the hands of someone else, and also at some point naming a UN or international arbiter and monitor to push along and help guide the Palestinians toward more self-determination and less concentration on violence, and help them build the structure of a civil society that can then become a state at the end of negotiations with Israel. So there's an effort by the Europeans to kind of listen to Bush, to understand what he's saying, to go along with him, but they are troubled by Mr. Bush's last speech, because it seemed to reject Yasser Arafat without providing any alternative. It seemed to many as a way of not pushing forward on a Middle East settlement, a kind of excuse for doing nothing. I mean, setting conditions so high the Palestinians couldn't possibly reach them, while setting very few conditions on the Israelis themselves. but among leaders who, you know, believe the United States is an important ally, want to be on the side of the United States. There is a lot of effort being made, some of it with gritted teeth, to find a way to take these pronouncements of a Republican administration in Washington and turn them into policy that, you know, other parts of the world can also go along with.
Before September 11th, President Bush was, I believe, seen in Europe as moving very unilaterally on things, not, you know, alienating allies, just doing what's best for the United States without a lot of consideration for what other countries felt or needed. Then after September 11th, there was this tremendous reaching out to other countries, trying to turn them into allies in the war on terrorism. How is Bush seen now in Europe in terms of being, you know, a unilateral kind of guy or an ally kind of guy?
He's still seen very much as a unilateral kind of guy. His, you know, President Clinton was ever emollient and seemed to get the tone right. I mean, though he, in many people's views, patronized the Europeans and in some sense, you know, lied, not lied in a sense of a falsehood, but, you know, when he signed the Kyoto Treaty on Environmental Protection, he knew it wasn't going to get passed, but he signed it anyway. Bush never played along. He simply said, we can't get this passed, so forget it. It's just partly it's a difference in tone, but there is a feeling that September 11th was an interim period, and yet in a way was a kind of accelerant of a lot of trends, underlying trends, and that as the war in Afghanistan has gone on, allies have been helpful allies and eager allies. And, you know, as you know, French planes are flying in Afghanistan and there are German troops there and German peacekeepers and British troops. And, you know, allies are playing perhaps a more significant role than many Americans realize now in Afghanistan. However, on things like the International Criminal Court, which was a very big and recent and quite bitter fight, there is again a feeling among Europeans that the United States is pursuing its own interests no matter what the interests are of its allies. And though it is discussing many things with its allies, it's not really listening very carefully. And that, you know, it seems unwilling to sacrifice anything that Washington thinks is in its own interests for the larger interests of the Western world. And lastly, I suppose, people feel that Washington is underestimating the value of allies themselves.
In Europe, which leaders are President Bush's greatest supporters and greatest detractors?
It's a good question. I mean, in general, the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, though he's, you know, from the center-left, has been a very important help to President Bush. I'm not sure they really like each other very much, but Britain always tries to straddle the ocean and to be an interlocutor between other Europeans and the United States and vice versa. But that stretch is getting very difficult for him. And the International Criminal Court was a blow to the British and a blow to Mr. Blair. He was ridiculed at home for his efforts to find a compromise. And many people felt that the Bush people had repaid his loyalty to them rather shabbily. Mr. Bush also has great support among the conservative Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, among the conservative Spanish Prime Minister José María Aznar, and among others. You know, and the United States in general, you know, has a lot of support in Germany, from where I'm speaking to you.
My guest is Steve Erlanger, Berlin bureau chief for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Steve Erlanger is my guest. He's the Berlin bureau chief for the New York Times. Let's talk a little bit about the impact of September 11th on Europe. You're based in Berlin, in Germany. Germany has been one of the important places in the investigation of Al-Qaeda because there have been Al-Qaeda cells there, and there have been terrorists based there who helped plan September 11th. Would you just kind of describe Germany's place as a location for Al-Qaeda planners?
Yes, Germany was absolutely central to September 11th. In Hamburg, beautiful port city to the north of here, where I've spent quite a lot of time, there was a cell of Arab students and immigrants to Germany who carried out September 11th attacks. I mean, they were considered the ringleaders and the planners, and they moved freely from Hamburg to America and back and all around Europe and sometimes to Asia too in pursuit of this rather amazing plot. So it's caused a lot of self-searching in Germany. After the Nazi period, the Germans, you know, with the help and advice of their American conquerors, put into place lots of very strong protections for the individual against the state and against state prying, data protection laws. And the Germans now believe some of those laws were so strong that they protected some of the Al-Qaeda sleepers who were in Germany, that, you know, had the state had more police powers and paid more attention to certain kinds of investigations, they might have uncovered this plot before it actually happened. Might have. But it's a big issue here.
There's a large Muslim population in many European countries. And I'm wondering if you're actually feeling tensions in communities, in the streets, in places where you've been in Germany and other parts of Europe since 9/11.
Without question, there is a great increase in tension and, you know, a great feeling that people in these communities have of being increasingly watched, not just by the police, but by their neighbors. Germany, as you probably know, has, you know, something like 3 million Turks who were brought to this country over the decades as guest workers, and many of whom settled here, many of whom now have German citizenship and raised families here. Turks are pretty secular, and there is a much smaller number of Arab immigrants and students, and it was from this population in general that Al-Qaeda converts came. But Germany is not, you know, the only issue here. The French have more Muslims than any other country in Europe, also more Jews. And, you know, partly it's French history. Many of these are Moroccan and North Africans. And in London, too, where there are quite a lot of immigrants from South Asia in particular, there have been some very interesting revelations about radical mosques in London and also in the north of England that seem to have been recruiting grounds for Al-Qaeda activists and jihad warriors, people who went to Bosnia or went to Chechnya. So the Europeans have woken up to a much bigger problem. You know, one could argue that their domestic intelligence services were looking at these places but weren't too worried because the targets of these people were not domestic. And after September 11th, that kind of, I think, sloppiness and selfishness has disappeared.
Do you think that Europe is dealing with immigration and security issues post 9/11 any differently as a result of the existence of the European Union than it would have been dealing with it just as individual countries?
It's a very interesting question, and I think that's true, because sometimes, you know, the way American politicians like to blame Washington for things that they don't want to do or that just get imposed on them, they think. Europeans can use the European Union that way too. But the European Union is 15 nations who, in a sense, you know, most of whom allow freedom of travel. You know, once you're inside it, you can go anywhere, the so-called Schengen visas. The British keep apart from this, partly because of the channel. But in general, you know, you can go all over Europe once you're inside without showing your passport to anybody. Now, that's a wonderful thing, but it's easier for terrorists to move. So there's a lot of concentration now on building up the borders of the EU to be, you know, more tuned toward serious challenges of immigration. And these are technical questions, but also there's an effort to cut illegal immigration as a separate political issue, because there's been a kind of conservative backlash in Europe, which is not really to do with September 11th, in my view, but certainly has been accelerated by it. So the effort to cut down on illegal immigration has become a European Union issue. And at its last big summit meeting in Spain, I think last month, this was a big, big topic. And there were no real, you know, resolutions, quick ones. But as a union, countries are trying to make their immigration requirements more uniform, so immigrants can't pick and choose. They're trying to make their refugee status requirements more uniform, and they are trying to crack down on people smuggling.
Cracking down on immigration was one of the issues that Jean-Marie Le Pen championed. He is the extremist right-wing French leader who did very well in the first round of the presidential election last April. Was his success encouraging or spurring on other extremist leaders through Europe?
Yes, but I mean, in a way, he was himself a beneficiary of an earlier movement against immigration. This is, you know, Jörg Haider, who's the far-right leader in Austria, who's not in the government, but whose party is important to the government, ran very strongly, you know, on a campaign of keeping immigrants out. And you see in other countries of Europe, surprising countries, the Netherlands, Denmark, not just countries like France and Austria, serious backlash against uncontrolled immigration, which is itself a kind of euphemism for shutting the doors. And it has echoes in Germany, too, where there's a big campaign that will end September 22nd and the possibility of a whole new government. And one of the issues here also is, you know, immigration.
Steve Erlanger is Berlin bureau chief for the New York Times. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Clan of the Cave Bear and all the novels by Jean M. Aul, already available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, comparing how religions and scientists have read the skies, we talk with Marcelo Gleiser, author of The Prophet and the Astronomer. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews Phil Donahue's return to TV, and we continue our conversation with Steve Erlanger of The New York Times. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Steve Erlanger. He writes about Europe for the New York Times. He's the Times' Berlin bureau chief and former bureau chief for Central Europe and the Balkans. I want to ask you a little bit about the euro and the European Union. Let's talk a little bit about the euro, and this might be of particular interest to any of our listeners who are planning to travel to Europe this summer. This week, for the first time, the euro became worth slightly more than the dollar. What's the importance of that?
Well, psychologically, it's very important because when the euro, which is used as the currency in 12 of the 15 European Union members right now, makes traveling very convenient. You know, you don't have to change money when you go from country to country. But when it was first introduced in January of 99, not as physical bills at that point, but as a currency that had fixed value against all these other 12 currencies, it started life worth, it was higher than the dollar. It was about worth $1.18 for 1 euro. And it started to sink immediately. And it's been sinking for more than 2 years. It reached a low of like 82.5 cents in the fall of 2000. But as Europe has been complaining more about the Bush administration and this sort of superheated American, you know, reach and patriotism and unilateralism, the fact that the euro is now back above the dollar has made people smile some in satisfaction. Financially doesn't mean very much. Currencies go up and down. And it really is much more to do with a weak dollar than with a strong euro. The dollar is at its low against the Japanese yen, too, and against the British pound. But it will make vacations in Europe a bit more expensive for Americans, but it shouldn't have a terribly big impact yet on exports and imports. The big fear people have is simply that the combination of now this big American trade deficit and this big American budget deficit, together with the stock market crash and scandals about American corporate practices, means that confidence in the American economy is being undermined and that there will be a flight of capital from the United States. A lot of it will go into euros. That's fine. But people worry that it's going to bring down, you know, the economy even farther. Nobody wants the dollar to fall too far, in other words.
Well, what impact is the euro having on creating a European group identity?
It has an important impact, you know. I mean, it is a physical, real thing. It's Europe in your pocket. And it's like, you know, every country has its own passport. But now in Europe, at least among members of the European Union, they all look the same and they say European Union on them. But people don't use their passports every day and they use their money every day. And I think more and more, you know, people do feel they're not quite sure what being a European is, but you know, you do find more young people in particular who are traveling and working all over the continent with a kind of freedom their parents find extraordinary, and it's an extraordinary success. You know, you ask them and some of them will say, yes, I'm a European. So there is, you know, something being built here called Europe. I mean, no one can quite define it. As I say, the European Union is going through, as it's trying to enlarge, it's also trying to reform its rules to make them more efficient. And it's trying to write itself a new constitution that will govern, you know, weighted majorities and how things work. But it is becoming more real as an entity, and it's becoming more real to the people who live here, too.
Is shopping different with the euro than it used to be?
Well, it is, actually, particularly if you're going somewhere. I mean, you know, if you're at home, fine. A lot of people still get confused because they still think in their old currencies. It was easy for the Germans because basically 1 euro is 2 marks, you know, so that was simple. A lot harder for the French because, you know, 1 euro was something like 7-point-something francs. But people are complaining a lot because prices have rounded up, you know, they think. And it's true, particularly on day-to-day goods like a cup of coffee or a roll at a bakery or a glass of wine or a bottle of beer. You know, people like nice round prices. So something, you know, that would have cost 2 marks before, you know, might cost 1 euro now, that would be a bargain. But in general, it's likely to cost 1.50 euro now. And people resent that. There's been a lot of talk about that. But certainly as a traveler, if you go anywhere inside the zone, it's wonderful. I mean, you don't have to change money at the airport. You just get into another taxi, use the same money. There's one nice little difference. The bills are all the same, and the coins are all the same on one side, but each country gets the right to, you know, put its own symbols on the other side of its coins. So that, you know, more and more in Europe, as the coins spread, you find yourself with a pocket full of coins that have, you know, that originated in France and Austria and Greece and Germany and Portugal. And people still like to find, you know, they talk about which ones are most attractive, you know. And I personally like the Portuguese 2 euro coin and the Italian 1 euro coin. But, you know, people collect them and kids collect them, and it sort of adds to this sense that, you know, this is one civilization. It has its differences, it has its problems, it's still fighting about lots of things. The nation state has not gone away. The French and the Germans are squabbling bitterly now over agriculture, for instance. But there is much more of a sense of an entity being born.
Well, let's get to the important stuff. I'm wondering, I don't know if you collect jokes or not, but I'm wondering if there's any good America jokes that have been circulating, or jokes about the American stock market, jokes about politics in America, jokes about the hunt for terrorists. Tell me.
I always feel sort of odd, put on the spot. I mean, I can tell you lots of jokes, but about current politics and America... harder. The funny thing that I saw recently, I don't know if it's true, but there's a great story going around, you know, there's this impression that George Bush isn't very smart, and that he actually was saying to another European leader about the French, he said, you know, the French don't even have a word for entrepreneur. That's a vignette.
Oh, I get it.
It's rather the way Ronald Reagan used to say, you know, the Russians don't have a word for peace. But of course, the Russians did have a word for peace, you know, mir. So, you know, you just never know. A lot of people, I must say, don't find the Bush administration a joking matter.
Steve Erlanger, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Steve Erlanger is Berlin bureau chief for the New York Times. Coming up, The Prophet and the Astronomer, what religions and scientists have seen in the skies. This is Fresh Air. Religions and science have looked to the skies to understand the cosmos and our place in it. The history of spiritual and scientific interpretations of the skies is the subject of the new book, The Prophet and the Astronomer, by my guest Marcelo Gleiser. He's a professor of physics and astronomy at Dartmouth College and author of the previous book, The Dancing Universe, From Creation Myths to the Big Bang. He grew up in Brazil. Early civilizations looked to the skies with awe, terror, and reverence. I asked Gleiser if early religions assumed the gods lived in the heavens.
Absolutely. So there were two things that were very important with the skies. The first one is that they were very regular. You know, things just repeat themselves. So you have day after day, you have a year after 365 days, you have the four seasons of the years. And so this regularity of the skies was very important for people to order their lives. They, in fact, depended on this regularity in order to know when to plant and when the floods were coming. And so they looked at the skies with this reverence, you know, in the sense that we owe our lives to the skies. And there's no doubt that many religions love the skies and, in fact, worship the skies.
Let's talk about the terror. What if some of the terrors that have come out of the skies that historically people ascribed a religious motive to?
That's the interesting part, because the skies are not always regular. You know, some weird things do happen in the skies. And for older cultures, you know, those weird things, unexpected, sudden things were very scary. Examples, a total eclipse of the sun. So if you put yourself, you know, in the minds of somebody that lived 10,000 years ago and that depended completely on the sun for survival and worshiped the sun as a god, and suddenly the sun starts to disappear in the sky and it gets completely dark in the middle of the day, you say, well, even if the sun comes back in a few minutes, you know, if it disappeared for a little bit, it may disappear forever. And then that's it. Life is gone. So that's one example of a great terror of the skies. And many different cultures have beautiful myths describing, you know, this battle of good and evil, of light and darkness that happens during an eclipse. Other examples which are very much present nowadays is comets. Comets have this very long history of being associated with some sort of prognostication, some sort of message from the gods. And the reason being that if the skies are the realm of the gods, whenever they have something to say to us, they're going to do it through the skies.
Now, do you think that scientific explanations of the stars and the moon and the sun and the comets and the eclipses, that those explanations helped calm people's fears about the skies or diminished their awe of the skies?
Well, maybe that was the original intention, you know. And in fact, right at the beginning of modern science in the 17th century, Newton and Halley, you know, Halley, the man of the Halley's Comet that tells that the comet can come back every 76 years or so, those people were the first ones to understand how gravity rules, you know, the motions in the solar system and in the universe in general. But they were also the first ones to show that, look, maybe there could be a collision between a comet and the Earth. And in fact, Halley himself had a theory of the biblical flood in which he said that, well, what happened was that a long time ago, a comet hit the Earth, and the impact was so violent that it tilted the Earth's axis, and the oceans just got sloshed around, just like if you could shake a bathtub, basically. And that was what caused the flood. And he even said there is an impact crater in the Caspian Sea due to that impact. So you see that the pioneers of modern astronomy were the first ones to bring back into science things that religious people were saying for a very long time. They're saying, look, cataclysms do happen, and now we have science to explain them. So I don't think science actually helped to diminish the fears. In fact, in a sense, it's kind of contributing to them.
I'm wondering if you're ever frustrated by the fact that although science is able to explain to some degree why certain cosmological events happen, or at least explain how they happen, it can't really explain the larger why of why it's happening.
Yes, I think that it's very, very important to put science in its proper place. It's precisely that science transforms the mystery of the unknown into a rational challenge. So it's not that science is taking away the mystery of things. What it's doing is that it's making this mystery accessible to us, to our own minds, to understand it. And in that way, science is very spiritual, because a scientist is devoting his or her own life to precisely try to understand what are these mysteries. And it's this relationship to the unknown that I think brings poetry to science and makes it a very humane enterprise.
Do you have any favorite stories about earlier civilizations and what they projected onto the heavens that you'd like to share with us?
I love the myth that comes from Shintoism in Japan, which is that Amaterasu, the goddess of the sun, which was the greatest deity for them. And in fact, that's why the Japanese flag has a rising sun there, right in the middle. And the emperor's family is, in fact, supposed to be descendant directly from Amaterasu, this goddess. And she was very upset because her younger brother was causing tremendous mass down on Earth. And she was so distressed that she decided to hide in a cave. So when she went into the cave, the world was all covered in darkness, and people were very nervous, and all the gods were very nervous. So they decided to lure her back. So what they did is they got a goddess to come to the entrance of the cave, and with a big mirror, and there were lots of people dancing, a tremendous mass outside. So Amaterasu was very curious about what was going on. So she walked out of the cave, and when she walked a little bit out of the cave, she saw her image on the mirror. And she said to the goddess holding the mirror, "Who is this person?" And she said, "Well, you know, this is the new goddess, since you're not interested anymore." And so she walked out a little more, and somebody from behind, you know, covered the entrance of the cave with a little string, which is called the Shimenawa. And Amaterasu couldn't go back in, and hence the sun went back shining into the world. Now, this myth is really a description of a total eclipse. And it's a myth that symbolizes the resurrection, you know, basically the coming back into life or into light of the world. And it's very beautiful. And so if you go to Japan and you go into a temple and you see those ornamental doors with a little string hanging, that string is the Shimenawa that didn't let Amaterasu go back into the cave.
You're the kind of astrophysicist who works more with computers and with math than you do with a telescope. Is it ever like looking at the shadows in a cave to to be working on the numbers and the math all the time instead of, you know, actually like gazing at the stars themselves?
Well, you know what, Plato's allegory of the cave that you mentioned, it's a good thing, because he used to say, you know, that there are two worlds, you know, the world of ideas and the world of the senses, and that the real world, the thing that is really crucial, is the world of ideas, not the world of the senses, because the senses are the shadows on the wall, and we may be misled by our senses. So if you really want to find truth, Platonic style, you go to the world of ideas. And funnily enough, you know, he is the guy, the pioneer of this quest for a mathematical elegance or description of nature. And a lot of physicists, including me, are very much hooked into this idea that math can describe nature in a very beautiful and efficient way. And so when I search for those models, I realize that I'm always going to have to simplify reality, because reality is just too damn complicated, you know, for us to explain in all the details. But we can simplify it, and through the simplification, we can build models that actually work, which is a beautiful thing. And so it's very exciting to be able to use mathematics and, of course, data from observations. You can't just, and that's where you diverge from Plato, you know, you can't do physics, you can't do science without looking to the outside, right? You have to be fed by data, because science is, most of science, apart from pure math, is empirically driven. So you have to find out what's happening in the world so you can describe it.
Well, you've had a lot of really interesting and even beautiful things to say about the skies. I feel what I really should ask you is, so what sign are you?
I am Pisces.
Yeah, you even know what sign you are.
Oh, of course. Boy, I sure do. And in fact, so is Einstein, funnily enough.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And how much do you care that you're a Pisces?
Not much. And in fact, the sad part of this is that, you know, I write a newspaper column for a Brazilian newspaper, and there's a big commotion going on now because a senator down there wants to regularize the profession of astrologer. So as being an official profession, and he said we should even teach astrologer up to the third grade, astrology up to the third grade. And so I received a ton of emails of people asking me to write something about this. So you see, astrology is pretty big, much bigger than astronomy, unfortunately.
Well, what do you think of astrology? What do you think drives people's belief that when you were born and where the heavens were at that time really determine your personality?
Well, I think what drives that, you know what the idea is, right, that there is some kind of unique cosmic arrangement every time somebody is born, right? Wherever the planets are with respect to the constellations, and this is somehow going to influence you. And I think the key point is the you with capital Y, because what astrology is doing is that it's linking the person to the big cosmos, is making that person very important and unique. And who doesn't like that, right? I mean, it's wonderful to think that all those things that happen in your life have a bigger reason, you know, and could be explained. And more than that, even your future could be explained. I think what's behind astrology and all sorts of numerology and everything and tarot reading is this deep, deep-seated need that we have to understand who we are and where we're headed to. And it's never going to go away because, you know, people are hungry for those kinds of answers, and astrology, good or bad, provides them. So scientifically, it's complete nonsense. But one thing which I think is good about it is that it forces people to think about themselves and about who they are. And that usually is a good thing.
Are you satisfied living in a world of great uncertainty?
Absolutely. I love that. And I think that's the difference between a religious person and a non-religious person, because in order not to be religious, you have to accept that you have to live in doubt, you know. And with religion, it's okay. You can always say, well, I have faith and I know where the answers come from. They come from God. So I can not worry about those things. And I say, fine, I prefer to be in doubt and go that way.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Marcelo Gleiser is the author of the new book, The Prophet and the Astronomer. He's a professor of physics and astronomy at Dartmouth College. Coming up, David Bianculli on Phil Donahue's return to TV. This is Fresh Air. Phil Donahue, the most successful TV talk show host of his day, returned to television this week as the host of a new show on cable network MSNBC. TV critic David Bianculli says that he, like MSNBC, expected a lot from Donahue, but so far he's been disappointed.
First, we have to remember what made Phil Donahue such a phenomenon in the first place. He burst out of Ohio and into national prominence because he gave voice to his audience, which was almost exclusively female. He was talking about issues that didn't get much airplay then, everything from abortion to AIDS, and sermonizing with enthusiasm about all of them. Donahue opened the phone lines to his viewers, becoming interactive before interactive was cool. He roamed the aisles of his studio audience with a handheld mic, relying on the crowd to react, and often to ask the tough questions so he didn't have to. It was good theater and good television, and sometimes it even educated. Without Phil, there would be no Oprah. Simple as that. But Donahue retired right as Oprah Winfrey lapped him in the ratings. That's a long time ago, and the TV landscape has changed enormously. We have discussion shows on cable now that are more interested in heat than light. We have so many channels and choices that the competition becomes not only greater, but frantic. Even in the very small world of cable news channels, where the three of them combined draw fewer viewers than the floppiest flop on UPN, there's a desperate attempt to fight for that same small piece of the pie. Fox News Channel has Bill O'Reilly in the same time slot that CNN has Connie Chung. And now, against both of them, MSNBC has Phil Donahue. But Donahue, in his first few days, has gotten off to a really bad start. Not in the ratings, where he came out of the blocks tripling the audience and finishing behind O'Reilly but ahead of Chung. His show, though, is almost unwatchable. Unwatchable because it's so unlistenable. This new Donahue show doesn't have a studio audience. Donahue has some guests seated around a table, like on Charlie Rose or Jim Lehrer, and others talking via satellite, like on Ted Koppel. Instead of pacing like a caged animal, Donahue stays seated, trying to get his guests, two or three of them at a time, to discuss the issue at hand. But they've obviously been encouraged to jump in and interrupt one another, and they yell a lot. So does Donahue, although without the handheld mic to control who's talking when, sometimes he gets drowned out too. And the TV director often focuses on someone who's not talking, while we hear other people yelling at each other, sounding like kids in a schoolyard. Here's a sample, a representative one, I promise you, from Monday's premiere during an alleged discussion about Iraq.
We have a brutal, murderous dictator, a regime that has murdered 5,000 of its own people, and they'd like nothing better than to kill us.
Yes,
they're
but
training,
it's also
they're
true.
They're training terrorists in three different
you're
training
not training terrorists. You have no facts about that. That
oh,
is
you didn't watch the PBS, the satellite
sites.
Yeah,
that's speculation from Ahmed Chalabi's fraudulent defectors, Mr. the CIA. Yeah,
Mr. Chalabi, are you being...
You change your mind so many times. You are such a chameleon.
Now, you're talking about Ritter now.
Enormously, right. Well, yes, of course, Mr. Ritter, you are a chameleon.
Mr. Chalabi, with so little time left,
you keep shouting. Now, listen, you know Saddam has chemical weapons.
I don't know
You know
that.
Saddam is
I
the world's older terrorist.
Don't say
You've
I
been
know
to
that.
Salman Park.
That's just silly and stupid and awful. And Phil, when squaring off against his guests, shouts just as loudly and looks like a cartoon parody of himself. He's playing to the back row, but on this show, he doesn't have a back row. I watched Tuesday's show just in case opening night was a case of nerves or was seen as so obvious a disaster that course corrections were instituted overnight. But no, Tuesday's discussions were just as loud and just as pointless. Phil, here's a piece of free advice from someone who expected to like your new show and would rather see you succeed than fail. Don't yell! If there's one thing on TV we don't need more of, it's rude behavior and pointless arguing. I can't believe, and I don't believe, you came back for that.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Denny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
HBO's Sex and the City begins a new season Sunday. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from star Sarah Jessica Parker and writer and producer Michael Patrick King. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.